In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to Life of the Week from History Extra, where leading historians delve into the lives of history's most intriguing and significant figures. Medieval leader and military commander Saladin has gone down in history for his role in the unification of the Muslim Near East, his capture of the holy city of Jerusalem, and his iconic rivalry with Richard the Lionheart. But is this extraordinary reputation just the product of his savvy PR team? Speaking to me, Emily Briffett, Jonathan Phillips charts the extraordinary rise of the Muslim leader who usurped his patron before reaching dizzying heights, and questions how his legacy has shifted and changed across the centuries. Hi, Jonathan. Thank you so much for joining us on the History Extra podcast.
Hi, Emily. Good to be here.
Today, we are going to be delving into the life of Saladin. And let's start with, who was Saladin?
Saladin was a Kurd. He was born in 1137 in the city of Tikrit, which is now in modern Iraq. And his family grew and moved through the hierarchy, if you like, of the Muslim Syrian rulers of the time. And he ended up, in part by usurping his former patron, he ended up becoming the Sultan of Egypt. He used that position to create a power base for his family. And then he rebelled against his former overlord. And when his former overlord died, he then took on the Crusaders. He spent 13 years gathering a fragile confederation in the Muslim Near East to take on the Crusaders, who captured Jerusalem in 1099 in the First Crusade. Saladin defeated them in 1187 and recovered the city for Islam. He then had to face the Third Crusade, made famous by Richard the Lionheart, which was an epic encounter. Pretty well, I think, a sort of nil-nil draw by the end of it. But he managed to see off the Third Crusade, and a few months after that, he died. So his career really dominated by the recovery of Jerusalem.
Now, there's so much in there that we have got to talk about. But just to continue setting up the context of this, are there any other names that we should perhaps know Saladin by?
Saladin is a title, and it means righteousness of the faith. But his given name is Yusuf. Which is really interesting. Joseph, in other words. He sort of seems very fond of that name, not least because, of course, the connotations of somebody who was sent into Egypt, who takes control of Egypt. He's happy to see Joseph as a figure to inspire and to give him some authenticity. And he's also very keen on things that resonate with that name. His name, the name Yusuf, is used in poetry about him quite a lot. But Saladin is absolutely what we know him as.
Similarly, what did he actually look like, if we're trying to picture him?
It's really strange. You'd have thought this man who is described, who's written about in so many texts, we'd have a very clear image of him. He's ill a lot, so I'm imagining somebody who's pretty slight. We know he had a beard because, A, lots of people had beards at that time, and B, he's described as tugging it at one point when he gets nervous. He's next to his son, who sort of says, "Dad is sort of tugging his beard." And the only other thing we know about him is that as he got older, he was going grey, and he did not want to dye his hair. He refuses to dye his hair. So there's clearly a thing about vanity that he rejects the idea of dyeing his hair. So I'm sorry, I can't be more detailed than that. And those are two curious little things. But that is what it is. I guess I imagine him looking. I have to say, the health troubles that he had in his later life, I imagine him looking, and just the scale of what he was engaged in, the duration of the struggles, I imagine him somebody who looked pretty tired and haggard a lot of the time.
So what can that sort of tell us about his personality and his character?
Yeah, I mean, his character, we do have a lot of information about Saladin, in part because his entourage, his household, were very keen to write him up. They were great propagandists. In some ways, if social media had been around in the 12th century, Saladin's team were all over it. They're endlessly writing letters about how great their front man is and what his achievements are. So he's got that kind of strong, sort of forward-facing, outward-facing PR profile, which, of course, is a worry. We're great for historians that we've got a couple of narratives from people who are in his household, who are sort of next to him at key moments and can see him crying or can see him angry or see him ill or see him praying. So we've got those wonderful insights. There's a slight worry that some of them almost read, there's a literary genre called Mirrors for Princes and how a good ruler should behave. Pious, merciful, generous, devoted, and he ticks all the boxes. So you worry, if isn't this just some kind of literary confection? While some of this can sound as if it's too good to be true, we can look at the text from other writers at the time, other Muslim writers. We can also look at sources written by Christian writers. And those, of course, are a rather good litmus test, because you'd think they'd be extremely negative about Saladin. And many of them are at times. But the most important one that I think we have is written by a man called William of Tyre, who's the great historian of the Crusader states. And he doesn't know Saladin's going to capture Jerusalem, so he's not writing through that prism. And he says there's three things about Saladin you need to be worried about. He's wise in council, so he's got good people around him. He's valiant in war. Not sure he's a great general, but we'll come to that. And he's generous beyond all measure. And for that reason, we need to be afraid of him. So he fixes on this idea of Saladin's generosity as being a real threat. And it's a part of his personality. I mean, most rulers are generous, but in Saladin's case, it's compulsive. He has to give a bigger and better gift than you do in diplomacy. But of course, if I give you something, it's not for free. I want something from you. And what I really want from you is your loyalty. And so that's a part of it. I mean, he does reward people when they serve him well, et cetera, et cetera. He also rewards the religious classes. So it's not simply rewarding warriors. If you reward the religious classes, they'll pray for you, which is helpful. And it means that they will also, I suppose, propagandize on your behalf. So there's a mixture of personality and strategy in there.
From there, what do we know about Saladin's personal life?
Yeah, this is really interesting. And I think, again, is away from the image of a holy warrior and an empire builder. He loved hunting. Any chance to relax, he would go out hunting. He loved polo as well. There's a lovely story that there's a great procession through Cairo. He's been given some black robes by the Caliph of Baghdad. It's incredibly hot. He gets back to the palace and he really calls his friends over and says, can we please go and play polo? I need to relax. So it's how you wind down of the pressures of being the hero of Islam and controlling this empire. And I find that very human. He also loved poetry. It's part of his personality as a man of adab, a man of culture. He's carried poetry collections around with him. He sponsors poetry competitions. So it's very much part of his life and his court. So again, we can't imagine this sort of constantly austere military situation. He loves hearing poetry and it encourages its composition. As far as his personal life goes, we know disappointingly little. He has this enormous number of sons. He only has one wife, actually, who was Nur al-Din, his patron's wife. And there's a lovely little story that when Saladin is very ill in Mosul, it looks like he's going to die. And he writes to her every day. So just this one glimpse that he looks like he's on the way out. So that shows a relationship and a devotion that really the texts don't give us otherwise. It's not something that they seem concerned to write about. But there's a sad twist there, because as he's writing to her, she's in Damascus, she dies. So, of course, they can't tell him, in case it tips him over the edge, that his wife has died.
I'd like to set the scene a little bit. If we start it in his early life, could you just give us the surrounding context of what's going on at this time?
The Crusader states are founded in 1099. The first crusade is called in 1095. Pope Urban II calls for the knights of Western Europe to go and liberate the Holy Land from the hands of the Muslims. And in it, he offers a remission of sins, a spiritual reward. And great armies leave the West looking to, recover the Holy Land, but also looking for honour. Small number of them are looking for land. Most of them come home, of course, but a few of them stay there and set up what we call the Crusader States. And the Muslim Near East that they encounter at the end of the 11th century is a very divided place. It's divided between the Sunnis and the Shiites. It's also politically fragmented. And it's the First Crusade. The Muslim Near East doesn't know what's hit it. Why should it? And for a long time, the Franks, as we call the Crusaders, once they settle, are able to exploit this and develop their territories. But in the course of the 12th century, the Jihad, the Holy War, which is an integral part of the Islamic faith, begins to gather momentum. And under a man called Nur al-Din, who actually turns out to be Saladin's patron, it gets somebody who's a great warrior, who's very pious, and can bring the religious classes and the warrior classes together. And he's the key to it. I mean, we know Saladin's name. I think this man, Nur al-Din, does awful lot of the hard work for Saladin. He's a great patron of religious classes, and he draws together Mosul, Aleppo, and Damascus. And that's a really powerful coalition of wealthy, important cities to start taking on the Crusaders and trying to recover Jerusalem. So Saladin fits into that.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So he's obviously growing up in this environment. What do we know about his early life?
Not much. Again, it's one of those curios. We know he's born into Crete. He moves from there when he's very young. He grows up in Damascus, which is one of the great cities of the Muslim Near East. And Nur al-Din is the ruler of Damascus. So in a sense, he grows up in this environment of the counter-crusade, the jihad against the Franks. It's also a bustling, interesting city. It's a sort of an intellectual hub at the time. So an energizing place to grow up. And his father and his uncle are the keys to this, because while they're Kurds, and in some way you might see as outsiders, his father is a very good administrator. He's a sort of an intellectual. And his uncle is a warrior. And he really is Nur al-Din's best general and is clearly an important part of him being able to step forward.
So when and where did Saladin's career, shall we say, begin?
In the 1160s, there's a great struggle for Egypt, which is the wealthiest area in the Near East. It's got the fertility of the Nile Delta and the great port of Alexandria. And so you've got Nur al-Din and the Syrian Muslims competing with the Crusader states for this great prize, which is ruled at the time by the Fatimids, who are a Shiite dynasty, but they're rather in decline. So they're a tempting target. And Saladin is there. Shirka is leading the invasion army. So Saladin's learning from his uncle. There's a siege in Alexandria, which the Crusaders win. Saladin's actually captured for 3 or 4 days by the Crusaders. He's a prisoner of war, which again is something that tends not to be mentioned. They treat him very well, and he's released shortly after that. But in January 1169, after a series of campaigns, it's Shirka who takes control of Egypt. And then almost just 2 or 3 months later, he dies from overeating. This man has got a gargantuan appetite, and he eats too much, and it does for him. So he just expires in March 1169. Just at the moment, you know, he's just achieved this great success. So who's going to replace him? And there's a big debate, and the person chosen is Saladin. And this really is where he comes to the fore. And I suppose for me, researching about him, this I found one of the most exciting moments. He's a Kurd in a Sunni Syrian invasion army. He's just conquered Egypt, which is Shiite. Lots of the Egyptians want to throw him back out. There's other invading forces, the Crusaders, the Greeks, Ethiopians, Sudanese, people from North Africa. How on earth does this bloke manage to pull together a confederation of the Muslim Near East? And then 18 years later, recover Jerusalem. And that kind of ascent or journey, to use a sort of, like you said, a tacky modern expression, is what grabbed me. So I that's how one of the things about Saladin that I find remarkable, going from that relatively unknown position and having authority really sort of landed upon him quite unexpectedly, that change.
So what are his next steps after that?
One of the things I think about Saladin that's really interesting is that he's quick on the learn. He's got Egypt. Oh my God, I'm ruling this land. How do I survive? He's very harsh with some attempts to remove him quickly, and he executes a lot of Egyptians. So he's tough. But he's also very good at getting administrators around him. Some of the existing administrators, you go, you're great. You're going to come and work for me. And he has a very loyal group of people around him. You often find people who are successful have a strong, stable group of people around them. And Saladin begins to assemble that. They stay with him for decades because they're so good. His family is good. They're good warriors. And they're pretty loyal to him. You think about how dysfunctional, say, the ruling House of England is at that time. Henry II, Eleanor of Aquitaine. The boys are always rebelling. Saladin's family, most of the time, stick with him. They can see he's, if you like, their front man, their best way forwards. He's also obviously pretty good at rewarding them. Some creaks and cracks later on, but basically they stick with him. So family, administrators, and also think he's quick on the learn. He comes into Egypt and he says, right, I'd like somebody to write me a book of etiquette and practices of this land. I want to know how this place operates, and I want somebody to write a book for me. He fairly quickly gets a survey of Egypt's economy done, a sort of doomsday book thing. So he wants to know what he's dealing with. So I kind of admire him in that sense for being smart.
So it's a bit of a combination of brains and connections, really, isn't it?
Yes, he works out how to, I mean, as a conqueror, I suppose you can try and smash people to one side and impose your authority that way. He's in a minority, and so it's just not going to work. So he has to be a bit more subtle. He has to work with the grain, I think, in many respects. Although in one key respect, he doesn't. And that is because as a Sunni, and a Sunni Muslim with his boss Nur al-Din positioning himself as champion of the jihad, the Shiites, whom they regard as heretics, are in the frame to be removed. And Saladin doesn't do it immediately. After a couple of years, the young Fatimid Shiite caliph, who's only about 19 or 20 years old, dies in Saladin's tender care of natural causes, you understand, and is not replaced. And in the khutbah and the Friday prayers, the name of the Sunni Abbasid caliph is read out. So that's the big change. So Sunni Islam, if you like, becomes the ruling religion of Egypt.
After he's consolidated his authority in Egypt, what then?
Saladin is effectively building his family a nest in Egypt. It's wealthy, it's powerful, and so he's establishing a sort of dynastic power base, which is all very well for his family. But there's Nur al-Din, his patron in Syria, who wants him to come and fight the Crusaders. And he sort of said, well, right, okay, let's coordinate an attack. You come from Egypt, I'll come from Syria. And Saladin always makes excuses as to why he can't come. Oh, there's trouble in Cairo, not possible, very sorry. And it's pretty obvious to Nur al-Din that this man is challenging his authority. And in 1174, Nur al-Din is so frustrated at this, he actually gathers his forces to march against Saladin. So you would have had, or you're about to have, a civil war. And Nur al-Din dies. One of the things that characterizes Saladin's career actually is good fortune. And having this man who was his patron, who he's basically rebelling in a state of rebellion against, dying just at the right moment, is one of those. He's also lucky 2 months later, because the king of Jerusalem is a man called Amalric, who's young, vigorous, dangerous as far as he's concerned. He also dies unexpectedly, leaving his son as a successor, who is a young boy who also has leprosy. So the scope, rather than facing a dangerous rule of Jerusalem, the politics of a young boy who's sadly very, very ill, means that the Crusaders, the Franks, look in on themselves quite a lot. So Saladin benefits from this. And then he wants to basically usurp Nur al-Din's empire. And so while we think of Saladin as a hero of Islam, the man who recovered the holy city for his faith, which is true, he's also a usurper, which is a more pejorative word. But it's basically what people do at the time. Nur al-Din had done exactly that. We're saying he's the great pious holy warrior. Yeah. But the people who were ruling Damascus before him may not have regarded him as such. He ejected them. So it is just what you do. But Nur al-Din, his family has got a lot of loyalty, a lot of supporters. And Saladin moves to Damascus, first of all, where he's able to take that over quite quickly. He grew up there. People know who he is. His family's been there. He marries Nur al-Din's widow as well. So he sort of binds himself into the community there. That's fairly straightforward. Nur al-Din has also left a young son who's up in Aleppo. And really, from about 1176, the next 10 years, Saladin is trying to take over. Nur al-Din's family is called the Zengid possessions. He needs Aleppo and he needs Mosul. And it's difficult because he's fighting his fellow Sunni Muslims. And people can say, hang on, you should be fighting the Christians. Isn't this all about getting Jerusalem back? And you're expending your energy, your money on fighting Sunni Muslims. And he has to propagandize that. He has to say that he's the best man to take the holy war forwards. He uses diplomacy and negotiation as well. So it's a difficult balance for him.
So what do we know about his motivations at this stage?
His motivations are a mixture. And he is certainly out to build an empire for his family, a dynastic empire for the Ayyubids. But he's also, I'm very, very certain, a devoted holy warrior. He is responsible for extending Sunni control into Shiite Egypt. He sponsors the religious classes considerably. And from the writers who are around him, we can see that he's obviously a devoted Muslim. His prayers, his devotion to his faith shines through. Not least also in his determination to recover Jerusalem, the third most important city in the Islamic faith, the place the Prophet ascended to heaven on his night journey. So there's a great moving in the continuum with Nur al-Din, a determination to recover Jerusalem for his people.
So speaking about the Crusader states, what was actually his relationship like with the Crusader states?
Having said he spent 13 years fighting his fellow Sunni Muslims, which is true, he needed Damascus, Aleppo and Mosul, which he doesn't get till mid-1180s. He needs the strength of those cities to be able to take on the Crusader states. Within the Crusader states, there's a lot of political infighting, the legacy of having this ill young man on the throne. And Saladin does, of course, actually have to fight them from time to time, having talked about it. And at first, he's not very successful. There's a battle called Montgisard in 1177, where he is absolutely hammered. He's very lucky not to be captured. And that is a real, real blow to him. And a couple of years later, the Crusaders build a castle at a place called Jacob's Ford, which is about a day and a bit's ride from Damascus. So right on the edge of his lands as a real, they've given it to the Knights Templar as well, a real statement saying, you know, you're doing pretty badly, aren't you? We can see that you're struggling a bit. We're going to build this great big castle quite close to Damascus. How does that make you feel? So he spends a long time trying to get that back. But actually, I think when he does recover or does take control of this castle, that is a bit of a turning of the tide. And from that point, he gets some momentum. He's starting to gather his resources. He tries to invade the kingdom of Jerusalem a couple of times, 1183, 84. But the Franks on this occasion are quite wise. They're like a boxer who stays out of range. He wants to fight them. He needs to fight them. And they just won't engage. And that frustrates him. But it's a sensible policy. By the time you get to 1187, he has been talking the talk for a long time now. And he's got this coalition. And he really needs to bring it to the boil. And I think he's almost desperate. It's a bit of a strong word, but he really, really needs a battle. And there's an incident where one of the Frankish rulers attacks a Muslim caravan in the Transjordan area, and he uses that as a sort of cause for war. And then in 1187, he invades the Kingdom of Jerusalem. He's got all his resources, really, really well organized, it has to be said. And he provokes the Franks into a battle. He takes a castle called Tiberias, where the Lady of Tiberias is in the castle. Her lord, her husband, is with the King of Jerusalem. And while some of them say, oh, you shouldn't fight, in the end, they decide to try to relieve this castle. And they're trying to march across about 32 kilometers of land in what is in now northern Israel in the middle of the summer. and Saladin has sorted out the water supply, there isn't any, and it's a disaster. Saladin's forces are bigger. They're able to compress the Franks, if you see what I mean, and shepherd them along, bombarding them with arrows the whole time. Saladin's got so much water, his men can pour water out in front of the Franks just to go, we've got it, and you don't appear to have any. They set fire to the dry brush, making sure that obviously the wind's blowing in the right direction to choke the Franks and really squeeze them to a standstill. And on the Horns of Hattin, which is a volcano, a dormant volcano with a sort of broken lip, that's where the King of Jerusalem's tent is pitched, and it falls, and the true cross, their great talisman, is taken, and Saladin has complete victory.
So this is a really triumphant moment in Saladin's story. How do we get from there to the recapture of Jerusalem?
Fairly quickly is the short answer. He has utterly broken the military strength of the Franks. He has many of the Templars and the Hospitallers executed. While we associate Saladin with mercy, these are the Christians' great devoted holy warriors, and there is a pressure upon him to act. He spends a little bit of time taking one or two other towns and cities, but he moved to Jerusalem fairly quickly in September 1187. It's a strong walled city. He spends a little bit of time outside it trying to attack it, but there's some negotiation. And he's under a little bit of pressure to avenge the massacre of 1099 when the first Crusaders came in and massacred the Muslim defenders of the Holy City. But it has to be said, the Frankish commander plays his not many cards that he's got, plays them very well. And he says, look, you're going to let us surrender. Otherwise, we're going to destroy the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And we know those are so precious to you. We've got a few hundred Muslim prisoners. They're going to be executed, and we're going to, because we know you're going to kill us, we're going to take a lot of you down with us. Do you want that, or do you want us to pay a ransom? And so the logical answer is concluded. They pay a ransom, which gives Saladin, of course, more money to reward people with. So this is a moment where his reputation for mercy really comes to the fore, or is created in many respects. Rather than massacring the defenders of Jerusalem, he ransoms them. And so what that means is, paradoxically, at the moment he's, if you like, stuck a stake in the heart of the Christian faith by recovering their city, at the same time he's done something actually probably rather unexpected and shown this form of power that mercy is. And it's going to be part of his later reputation.
So he appears to walk this quite fine line between this sort of brutish force, but also real diplomacy and mercy. Could you tell us a little bit more about this side of him, how he manages these expectations versus what he actually does?
Yes, I mean, it is, you've got to choose your moment, I suppose. And when he recovers Jerusalem, he's very keen to tell everybody about it. People have been criticizing him for fighting his fellow Muslims for, if you like, pushing his own family's advantage. And so his household start writing, well, other families have tried to get back Jerusalem. They failed. The Ayyubids, Saladin's family, have done so. You can draw your own conclusions as to divine favour in this, ladies and gentlemen, and it looks good for us. He is very, very keen on showing that God has approved of his actions and he's succeeded. And you can't blame him either for that. And so he, as he would see it, cleanses the holy places. He puts great decorations, mosaics. Interestingly, with the name Yusuf is included in there, he wants to make sure that he is name-checked, and again, understandably so. And he is very, very obviously rightly proud of this achievement. And this is clearly the crowning moment of his career and gives him great capital. People want to come and pay their respects to him. It is the ultimate boost to his authority. So once he's got Jerusalem, yes, he looks to consolidate that. But as far as his motives going forward, he's then created an immediate problem because he knows he's just pressed the starting button on what we know as the Third Crusade. So he's got to, again, balance keeping Jerusalem for the Islamic faith and then preserving also this large empire that he now rules. And that's a real challenge.
The Third Crusade sets out. How does Saladin tackle this? How does he deal with it?
Well, the Third Crusade is the greatest crusade, arguably, of all of them. You've got Richard the Lionheart, King of England. You've got Philip Augustus, King of France. And the biggest figure of the lot is Emperor Frederick Barbarossa of Germany. So you've got the three sort of heavyweights of Western Europe throwing their might at Saladin. And he has got to try to take as much of the Crusader states as possible and to sort of create a strong defensive position, but also to get people on his side, to call up the people across his lands. You've got to help me. It's your duty to help me. And the catch is that the Third Crusade lasts for a very, very long time. 1188, people start arriving in the Near East. It finishes in 1192. And it's quite easy to get people to come and help you when you're winning. And it also means you've got rewards to give them. But when you're struggling or things are at an impasse, you know, you've really got to dig deeper and be more persuasive or more pushy or more desperate. All of those things, and obviously more diplomatic and more skillful in keeping people on your side. So I suppose you would have to say, well, you'd have to admire Saladin for being able to do that for that long. But the other thing to bear in mind is he still rules the Yemen, Egypt, Palestine, Syria, northern Iraq. And there's people on the borders there. He's still got to administer those lands. That's still sort of ticking along, if you see what I mean. And that's not to be forgotten.
What were the key moments in the Third Crusade?
The great set piece of the Third Crusade is the Siege of Acre, which is a city now, Acco, right in northern Israel. And this is the best port along the coastline. And King of Jerusalem, who lost the Battle of Hattin, who's rather humiliated, has been freed by Saladin. And he makes an amazingly clever move and tries to besiege the city of Acre, which is held by Saladin. Saladin wasn't expecting this. And Saladin ends up besieging the man who's besieging Acre, if you see what I mean. It's like layers of an onion. And this bid by King Guy to recover this coastal port becomes the focus of the Third Crusade. His brother had said, look, basically, you've been pretty hopeless so far. People are coming over from Western Europe. They need to see something kingly from you. So he makes this dramatic move in trying to take Acre. And as I say, it's an incredibly brave and actually smart move. And it becomes an epic siege. The contemporaries describe it akin to the Siege of Troy. Okay, it's only 2 years, not 10, but anyway. It is an epic, epic siege. And over the course of 1189, 1190, 1191, you've got crusaders arriving from Western Europe. Every time that the sea lanes are open, they're closed between October and March, you get thousands of Westerners inspired by the loss of Jerusalem, having sacrificed their livelihoods, their lands in the West, in the sense they've had to sell some of them, risking their life and limb to come and try and recover Jerusalem. But the focal point first is this great Siege of Acre. And so Saladin has to try and break through the Crusader ranks. They've built this enormous earthwork. Earthworks sound kind of Viking-y, but this massive kind of earthwork around the city, which Saladin can't break through. So for 2 years, Crusaders effectively live in this kind of enormous campsite around Acre, which is an intriguing thing to try and get your head around. But they're always arriving. Many of them are dying from illness, but it is a great, great struggle. And Saladin is just frustrated outside. It's an incredibly arduous siege for both groups. There's a point where they decide to call a truce because they're mentally and physically exhausted on both sides. The struggle that Saladin has to maintain morale and his own health. That's one of the things about Saladin I found quite interesting is his own health is dire. He suffers from colic, which I think of, I suppose, as babies and horses, but it's terrible, terrible stomach pains and bile and vomiting. He can't get out of his tent sometimes. He can't get on his horse. His immune system looks like it's packed in. And so you don't think of the sort of the holy warrior confined to bed, clutching his stomach for weeks on end. But that's the reality of it. And so this great siege outside Acre is in some ways the focus of the Third Crusade.
How does this siege actually resolve itself?
The Third Crusade has been building up outside Acre for the arrival of the great monarchs of the West. Saladin's good fortune kicks in one instance. Frederick Barbarossa, the ruler of Germany, with an enormous army, has bullied his way past the Greeks, Constantinople. He's defeated the Turks in Asia Minor, and then he tries to swim a river. And he drowns. He's quite an elderly man and he drowns. And the loss of the ruler of Germany causes the German army to break up. And Saladin was terrified. This is such an intimidating prospect. And the relief and delight that this great challenge to his strength has gone is considerable. But Philip Augustus of France and Richard the Lionheart are still on their way. And finally, in the summer of 1191, Philip turns up. He's an effective enough warrior, but Richard the Lionheart is the main act. And as Saladin's secretary records, well, the Crusaders have been telling us about this guy for a long time. They've been saying what a great warrior he was. He would kind of get advanced billing, if you see what I mean. And he turned up and their delight was great and our position became more difficult. I mean, yes, Richard is a complex figure, but he's amongst that, he is an extraordinarily effective general. And with the momentum and all the troops he brings, the Siege of Acre is broken. The people inside, Saladin's colleagues, if you like, inside, have to surrender. And that falls into Crusader hands. So a big breakthrough, a big humiliation for Saladin after 2 years of trying to get in. And then also at the end of it, what can only be described as a war crime, when Richard executes about 2,500 prisoners in cold blood, which again, as well as being an atrocity, is something that humiliates Saladin. Obviously, it infuriates him and horrifies him. But again, it's showing you can't look after your people. So that is the end of the Siege of Acre. And then the next phase of the Third Crusade is Richard trying to capture Jerusalem. He marches down the coast. He defeats Saladin in a battle at Arsuf. Again, Richard's directness in battle is considerable. But then trying to get Jerusalem is rather different. Jerusalem is quite a long way inland. If you were going to say you were going to drive it from the coast, it would take you, say, 50 minutes now, the first half of which is the coastal plain. And then it's quite mountainous. And it's awkward to try to get through that terrain. Saladin has managed to slow the Crusaders down to get them towards the winter of 1191. That, again, makes it very difficult for Richard, and he has to turn back. He tries again in the early summer of 1192, and he just basically comes to the conclusion that if he besieges Jerusalem, he won't be able to hold it. He's worried about supply lines, but he doesn't believe he can hold it, which is odd. His explanation is, well, I don't want to be seen as the man who got Jerusalem back and then lost it. It's a sort of, I don't want my reputation to be damaged by success and then failure. So it's a curious calculation, but one that he makes as a general, but one which devastates his army. His army are furious. They're very upset. You know, why else had they come all this way other than to get back the holy city? And some of them get to see it in the distance, and he doesn't want to do it. So it's a real moment of complete plummeting of morale.
Outside of the big battles, what else was actually going on?
The answer is diplomacy. Outside of battles and raids, there's an awful lot of diplomacy in the course of the Third Crusade. Richard wants to meet Saladin. He seems convinced that he can make some progress, but Saladin refuses. He says that rulers only meet when there's an agreement between them. We don't want to meet and then go back to fighting. He's very clear on that. So the man who spends a lot of time with Richard over the next few months is Saladin's brother, who we know as Saphaddin. And I think a lot of our view of Saladin down the centuries is a bit of Saphaddin as well. I think it's a composite. And he and Richard end up meeting on many, many occasions, and they actually get on very well. And this is where I think some of Saladin's reputation, positive reputation, comes from. They can talk about diplomacy, they like hunting, they like food, and they like music. So the whole part of diplomacy is, of course, then gift giving. Okay, you are trying to suss out how strong the other side is and all that kind of thing. But they spend a lot of time with each other. And some people say they're getting on too well. This is meant to be holy war. So you have, as the crusade goes on, the stresses and strains on both sides, political tensions on the Christian side, political tensions on the Muslim side. Richard is ill. Saladin is ill. They're both running out of money, morale. There's a need in the end for diplomacy to take place. There's one more big battle at Jaffa. Saladin takes the initiative, besieges Jaffa. Richard has to come down in emergency, strides ashore, does great deeds of daring and heroism. But again, that was really a sort of a powerful flicker, and nothing comes after that.
I think that adds a really interesting angle to it, because we often see the Third Crusade as this big battle between Richard versus Saladin, and it gives you a whole other view on it. So how exactly does the Third Crusade come to its end?
It ends with a negotiated truce. It's agreed that there will be a truce for 3 years and 8 months. And the Crusaders can visit Jerusalem as pilgrims peacefully to go there. And groups of them do. Richard himself won't do it, but some of them go. And some of them actually then meet Saladin himself. And so there he is, as generous, as courteous as you'd have wanted him to be. And so we have some nice conversations recorded between them when he expresses admiration for Richard and vice versa. So you've got this kind of moment where it really comes to a finish in late 1192. After that, Saladin is obviously exhausted. He talks about maybe going on the Hajj, which he hasn't done yet. He goes to Damascus, his favourite city. He goes hunting with his family. But in early 1193, he falls ill. And I think in some ways you can understand this as being the exhaustion of the years of struggle that have gone before. He has stomach pains. He's vomiting. The physicians try to help him with bleeding and emetics and things like that, which of course just weaken him. And he ends up dying on the 4th of March, 1193.
After his death, what was his immediate legacy?
When Saladin dies, having established this Ayyubid empire, this family empire in the Near East, it fragments incredibly quickly. It shows, if you like, his authority as the leading figure, the guiding figure there. Some of the problems are of his own making. He has got 17 or 18 sons, which is, yes, quite a lot to reward and keep happy. And by this time, some of the lads have grown up, and he's been giving them territories to rule. He's not handled that with his usual assurance, actually. He gave one of them Aleppo and then took it back, which obviously causes upset. But effectively, you've got a new generation of people who want to stamp their authority across these bits of land, and they end up fighting one another. It sounds remarkable, but within months, you've got these wars between members of Saladin's family. The person who comes to step in is brother Safaddin, who I have to say I should have made more of. He's been at Saladin's side throughout this lifetime, if you like, and is always Saladin's key confidant. He's somebody who Saladin turns to at times of need. And Uncle Safaddin, as it were, comes in and after a little while bangs the boys' heads together and say, okay, we need to sort this out properly. He doesn't rule the whole lot again. He's based in Egypt, which is the senior partner from its wealth and things like that. So it does stabilise a bit, but it requires Safaddin to do so.
After Safaddin has calmed this situation down a little bit, where does the Ayyubid dynasty go from there?
They're rulers of Egypt, Syria, for a few decades, but their dynasty actually ends effectively in 1250 when the Mamluks, the slave warriors, kill a man called Turan Shah, who was the Ayyubid. There's a period shortly after that when his stepmother, a woman called Shajar al-Dur, she marries one of the Mamluks, and that dynasty then prevails for centuries. So the Ayyubid dynasty is actually pretty short-lived, although not that Saladin was to know that. But there is a sense where Saladin's legacy does continue, and you can find the Mamluks refer to him. There's lots of copies of the texts, the histories of Saladin, the lives of Saladin. He's there in the landscape as the man who built the citadel of Cairo. He's there as the man who recovered Jerusalem. In poetry, in jihad texts, in multiple histories, all sorts of things. His memory is there. He's not a dominant figure, but you can find traces of the memory of Saladin down the centuries. An interesting one would be in Ottoman Istanbul, the next dynasty after the Mamluks, if you like. And there, late 16th, early 17th century, a great administrator says, books of history are overflowing with accounts of Saladin's life. He was effectively an example of how to rule. And I think that's a really powerful piece of evidence, talking, you know, two dynasties down the line, several hundred years later, a man in Istanbul is going, there's lots of history books written about Saladin. And he's an example of how to rule. It's not just he's an example of a man who's recovered Jerusalem for Islam, yes. He's also an example of effectively good government. And so this really underscores his ability as a man of justice, a man of generosity. And so those other elements of his character, I think, are a big part in his durability down the centuries. He's somebody whose qualities as a ruler you could admire, not just his success, which is obviously the core part of it, but you can take, if you like, the bits of his administration, his personality that you want. You can ignore some of the other things. I mean, people invoke memory for presentist purposes, if I can put it like that. So you might want to ignore that he's a usurper or that he executed this, that, the other, etc. But there are enough well-attested positive things that you can pull those and you want them to adhere to you, if you like. He's also this man who drew the Near East together. And that, if you think down the centuries, particularly recent centuries, is something that is so hard to do. However, in such a sort of fragile confederation, he did it. And that, again, is something to aspire to. The qualities that enabled him to do that is something that many people down the centuries want to join themselves with.
And what about in the West? What's his legacy over here?
Saladin's legacy in the West is quite interesting because as the man who recovered Jerusalem, in the short term, he is held out as the son of Satan. There's a wonderful image of the seven-headed beast of the apocalypse, and Saladin is head number six. He really is seen as incredibly evil. But that changes quite quickly. And in the course of the Third Crusade, because the Third Crusade lasts such a long time, there's such proximity between the Crusaders and the Muslims, and this diplomatic exchange. It doesn't lead to a positive view of Muslims, but this man, and I think his brother a bit blended in, comes across with all the qualities that Western Europeans like about themselves. Chivalry is the great cultural driver of the 12th century, which is bravery, kindness towards women, which again Saladin is well attested to, mercy, generosity, piety, culture. And he's got all of those things. And Westerners go, wow, he's actually rather like us after all. And he's clearly successful. And so his kind of mirroring comes back to the West very quickly. In many, many little examples, there's a poem written to the King of Germany early in the 13th century. It says, you need to be more like Saladin. Saladin gave away money when times were good because he was generous, not just when it was a crisis. He did it all the time. You should be like Saladin. So the fact that the King of Germany is having Saladin held up as a benchmark for behavior is, you know, hang on, I thought he was the son of Satan. Well, he's not. So you've got this kind of moving in of a positive image. His chivalric behavior, there's the Handbook of Chivalry is written in the 1220s. Saladin's one of the key people in that. You've got people calling their son Saladin in Oxfordshire in the 1240s, which is a pretty strange thing to learn. You've got him also taking a place in romantic literature. It becomes completely improbable. He can disguise himself and come to the West, seduces Western women. He auto-baptized himself on his deathbed, which is complete nonsense, of course. But you have these sort of almost literary kind of life coming through. But also other things in the 16th, 17th century, Saladin, while he was very generous, was personally quite austere. He was not somebody who luxuriated in personal wealth. And that's held up as an example of the transience of worldly wealth in sermons in England in the 17th century, which is, what is Saladin doing here? But it's that is part of it. So he has this durability. Then things like Walter Scott, The Talisman, extraordinarily successful in the 19th century, that kind of keeps it going.
He's attained such a mythic stature in the popular imagination. Now, I wonder if you could tell us some of your personal favourites or ones you maybe find a little disappointing or heartbreaking or, well, let's say interesting retellings or uses of Saladin and his story.
Yeah, there's many examples, and I should have said more about his legacy in the Muslim Near East, where when you come to the 19th and the 20th centuries, when Westerners are invading and establishing a presence in the Near East, he then, as I say, he was remembered down the centuries, but he really comes to the fore for Arab nationalists, for Islamists, as somebody who represents the unity of people against outside invaders. And that's his key role, if you like, across all sorts of groups, as I say, be it someone like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Arab nationalist rulers like Nasser, Assad, Colonel Gaddafi, etc., etc. So he's there. You need to go further and not just associate him with those figures or movements. He's a part of the culture of the Near East. He's there in plays and in literature, in films, in documentaries, statues, stamps, banknotes. It's a really kind of deep presence. And one really nice reminder of that was I was talking in Detroit, where there's a big Syrian refugee population, and this young woman came up and said, I'm from Hama. And you need to know that Saladin was the screensaver on all our mobile phones. And I thought that really struck me as a sort of remarkable, if you like, testimony to his durability and appeal to people. A more curious example, I suppose, of his durability relates to Saddam Hussein. And I spoke to the man who debriefed Saddam Hussein when he was captured. And Saddam identified himself with Saladin and was talking about mercy. I think this was in the last few weeks of Saddam's life when it was pretty obvious he was going to be executed. And he said, of course, the one thing you must know is that Saladin was merciful and kind. When he learnt Richard the Lionheart was ill, he disguised himself, ducked into Richard the Lionheart's tent and cured him of his illness with his medical skills and then snuck away. And this is actually part of Walter Scott's talisman. So Saddam Hussein, in the last weeks of his life, is effectively regurgitating a story that was conceived by Walter Scott in the early 19th century and has then moved its way through. The talisman was translated into Arabic, performed on the stage in Cairo in the 1890s, through movies. There was an enormously successful movie in Egypt in the 1960s called El Nasser Salah Ad-Din. And then Saddam must have seen that endlessly. And that has the scene of Saladin creeping into the tent. And then Saddam repeats it. So while that's not at all true, I think it's, again, an interesting historical line, but just a testimony to what people want to believe about him.
Who's invoking the memory of Saladin today, then?
One of the most interesting examples is President Erdogan of Turkey, where Saladin is obviously important to the appeal of supporting the Palestinians, broader kind of history of the region, but also to the Kurdish population as well. And down in the southeast of Turkey, there's a Saladin airport. There's many mosques are named after him, hospitals, schools. And right now there is a major TV series, a dramatization of Saladin's life on Turkish television. Enormously popular, apparently.
Taking all this in, how do you think we should be thinking about Saladin today? What do you think listeners should take away?
I suppose an appreciation of the range of his character, that he is a very pious man. He's determined to recover Jerusalem. But there's a lot more to him as an effective ruler, a generous ruler, a good administrator, somebody who's able to understand and work with people. I think those are his great skills. His skill as a diplomat as well, to bring people together. So I think it's really the range of things that he is capable of doing. And I suppose his durability. When you read about the struggles that he faced, I think it's quite remarkable that he managed to survive physically.
That was Jonathan Phillips, Professor of Crusading History at Royal Holloway, University of London, and author of The Life and Legend of the Sultan Saladin, first published by Bodley Head in 2019. Jonathan also recently appeared as an expert guide on our First Crusade podcast series, as well as a whole host of extra bonus content. Simply search First Crusade on historyextra.com to find out more. Finally, Jonathan will also be appearing alongside a host of other historical experts at CrusadeCon, a one-day history conference open to the public at Glastonbury Town Hall on Friday the 19th of April 2024. Head over to crusadecon.co.uk to find out more and purchase your tickets.